This is our league, and this is your league. From the 55-yard line on CFL America Radio and the Sports History Network.
Stand by, 15 seconds to air. Stand by, all cameras and videotape.
Ready with your opening graphics. Stand by, Howard. Here we come, Frank. Ready, Don.
Stand by, audio, your opening music, and roll tape.
Take tape.
ESPN celebrating 150 years of college football.
When mama calls, you just have to come running. So said Paul Bear Bryant upon his acceptance of the Alabama head coaching job in 1958. The once proud Tide had won just four games against 24 losses and two ties in the three seasons before Bryant's arrival. But beyond the challenge awaiting him on the field, Bryant had come home in the midst of one of the most difficult times his state had ever seen. Times that would often blur the lines between football, politics, and the very identity of the South itself.
Stadium, the inaugural Liberty Bowl game highlights. Richie Lucas of Penn State burst through the Crimson Tide of Alabama for a 24-yard gain to pull the Nittany Lions out of a hole.
When Bryant came back to Alabama in 58, it was just 3 years after the bus boycott, Rosa Parks. He did something very important, subtle from the scope of history, but important at the time. In 1959, when Alabama won a bowl invitation to play Penn State, Penn State had a couple of black players. The opposition to that among the Board of Trustees was significant. Bryant butted against that. He said, no, we're going to play. We're going to play integrated teams. That's who we are. At a time when a state law still prohibited them from bringing integrated teams into the state. That kind of helped melt resistance to what was then thought of as race mixing.
Penn State beats Alabama 7-0.
Tell me what's more important than college football to the South after 1961 other than race and maybe religion, but those are, you know, race and religion are sort of subsumed in sports. It is almost like there's this symbiotic relationship between race and even the economy and economic opportunity and sport. And it's like they're this wired together.
That relationship was a deeply embedded part of life all throughout the South as the 1960s began. But as the decade would unfold, nowhere would it be more significant than the state of Alabama. With the turmoil rising in concert with the ascent of the Crimson Tide program,
we need an interception
under Bear Bryant.
We're behind. They're all fired up. We got class. We're going to find it out. We got class, and I know we got it.
Get that defense ready now. Get that kickoff team ready.
Harrison Salisbury wrote a very famous or infamous article to white Southerners in the New York Times in 1961. And the headline says it all. Fear and hatred grip Birmingham. Birmingham was in the throes of the absolutely brutally violent divisions caused by massive resistance to desegregation.
When a group of freedom riders from the North arrived in Birmingham that spring of 61, the city's public safety commissioner, Bull Connor, incited the local KKK to set their bus on fire.
They were holding the door, and some Klansmen said, that fire is over there by the gas tank on the bus. We better get out of here. Okay. And they turned the door loose and ran for their lives, which gave the Freedom Riders the opportunity to get off the bus. People, you know, almost got burned to death.
Still, the Freedom Riders were badly beaten.
You can never whip these boys if you don't keep you and them separate. I found that out in Birmingham. You've got to keep the white and the black separate.
And Bryant's Alabama teams represented to white Southerners everything that was right with their society, that these are not the outcasts. And they represent our norms, our values.
He knew that to have a winning season, that we had to have real fine leadership from within the squad.
They're undersized. They're underdogs. And they're just from these little old small towns. They're like us.
It was 1961. I was a red shirt, and Coach Dodd very wisely took the red shirts on most trips. Even though we weren't going to play, he wanted us to be exposed to Birmingham. And Chick Granning was one of our leaders. He was one of the tri-captains of the team.
Darwin Holt blocked Granning on a punt.
Darwin drilled him with an elbow and shattered his face, knocked his teeth out, broke his face. He hurt Chick so badly that it ruined his life.
The national media began a very negative focus on Paul Bryant in 1961 with an article, a profile of him in Time magazine, in which they portrayed him as brutal and obscene, basically saying that Bryant teaches his players dirty football. He's just like all of those redneck whites down in Alabama.
Coach Bryant trying to defend his man because he was being adjudicated by the public. What it did is it severed the good feelings and relations between Dodd and Bryant.
Alabama would finish the 1961 season 11-0, and a victory over Arkansas in the Sugar Bowl cemented a national championship. Coach Bryant's first title.
With my limited vocabulary, there's no way that I can adequately say how very proud that I am of the football team.
The spring prior to that landmark season, Alabama had a visitor from a faraway land, Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania.
In 1961, Joe Namath is not going to be able to go to the University of Maryland because he missed his boards by a few points. Bryant gets a call from one of his coaching friends and says, this guy's going to be available, and you know, I don't want to play against him. You need to see if you can get this kid.
We were getting ready to go into training camp. The guy that was coaching up there, a drinking buddy of Bryant's, Bryant comes in and tells us about Namath. And he said, we got to get you up there real quick and get him to come back and just visit. So Carney Lashley, our AD, goes in his desk drawer and reached down in a gunny sack and pulls me out of a wad of bills. And he puts them down. He said, that ought to be enough for a ticket. Put it in my pants. Didn't know how much it was. I should have checked it.
I was focusing on basketball. I really wasn't sold on going to college yet. But when I did get the results of my college boards, that day, Howard Schnellenberger was at the door. He talked to my mother for the most part, and she simply went upstairs, packed me a bag, and came back and said, "Are with me?" and said, "Here, take them."
So I took him out to the field, but there I came in with this big, good-looking white guy from Pennsylvania. Bryant says, "Hey, coach, send that boy up here to see me." 40 stairs to get up to the top of his tower.
Nobody had ever gone up on the tower. Who is this guy?
Clearly, he was no Alabama farm boy.
Had long hair and a duck tail, and came out of the dining hall after lunch with a toothpick in his mouth and one behind each ear. And so we nicknamed him Toothpick for the first year he was there.
Alabama state law requiring segregation of races on buses still stands. As long as I am president of the Alabama Public Service Commission, I am going to see that our segregation laws are upheld.
Off the field in Alabama, Namath encountered an alien world.
I wasn't educated to what segregation was. I don't know if I ever heard the word prior to going down there. I really was caught off balance. My first introduction to it were two water fountains in the Greyhound bus station. One was colored, one was white with the sign. And, whoa, you know, this is different.
In the community, the rumor was that Joe was not a racist. That Joe treated everybody equal. Combined with his looks, his charisma, and the fact that the guy, he was one of the greatest arms of all time. Hey, Joe was a man.
Knock his head off, see the ball.
On the field, Joe discovered a kind of military approach that was just as foreign to him.
Boy, back then, you know, it was still a hands-on kind of coaching. They were more physical, literally. I had run an option play around right end, got hit, pitched the ball was on the ground. And I don't know really what happened then, but I heard Coach Bryant yelling at me, "Son, not your job just to get out there, pitch the ball. You got to get on it if it hits the ground." And I'm getting up and I'm walking back saying, yeah. And the next thing I know, he had my face mask and he lifted me up. He was a good-sized man. He said, "Son, when I talk to you, you look me in the eye and say, sir." I said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir."
In 1962, his sophomore year, Namath got the starting job. Pat Trammell, his predecessor, had been a running quarterback. Well, Namath could run, but what he could really do was throw. Alabama receiver Richard Williamson put it plainly, Pat Trammell couldn't throw like that. We hadn't seen anybody who could throw like that.
We heard that he was the best quarterback in the country when he came in. And yeah, he was really good.
Bryant would call Namath the greatest athlete he ever coached.
Alabama, undefeated in 27 games, takes on Georgia Tech. And those Ramblin' Wrecks get going as Mike McNeames intercepts a Bama pass and gallops back 26 yards to the 14.
Ranked number one in the country, Alabama traveled in mid-November to Atlanta, where Georgia Tech, Bobby Dodd, and the Yellow Jacket fans hadn't forgotten the Darwin Holt hit from the year earlier. Bryant tried to make light of the situation by wearing a football helmet out onto the field in pregame. But a 7-6 loss to Georgia Tech would be no laughing matter.
In the very first meeting as freshman with Coach Bryant, Coach Bryant told us, fellas, you know, we're going to win some games here. We're going to win a lot of games. We might lose some. And I'm going to tell you, you're going to remember those games that we lost sooner than you're going to remember the games you won. And he was so right.
Cotton Clark pulls his way into the line. Touchdowns, 7-6. Alabama needs 1 point to tie, 2 to win.
When I'm doing something, swimming, working, walking, working out, folk, doing some other things, my mind's wandering, I think of the games we came up short.
Alabama decides to go for broke and run the conversion for 2 points. It doesn't work. Georgia Tech scores the upset of the season.
To this day, that 7-6 loss, I think about that quite a bit.
But the Tide would finish the 62 season strong with a rout of Auburn. And then an Orange Bowl victory over Oklahoma.
Sophomore Joe Namath sparks the nationally rated Alabamians with a bullseye 26-yard pass to Dick Williamson. Touchdown, Alabama.
But the damage had been done. The Georgia Tech game had cost them a national championship. In the early 60s, Johnny Vaught was arguably the most powerful man in the state of Mississippi. Success on the gridiron will earn you that here. He's the only coach to ever win an SEC title for Ole Miss, and he won 6 of them, along with a share of the 1960 national championship.
One day he's coming back from Memphis, and he's blowing down the highway in that Cadillac that somebody gave him. And the highway patrolman stops the car and says, "Why, Coach Vaught, do you realize you're going to 85? And Coach Vaught said, "No, son, but I certainly appreciate you telling me." He rolled his window up.
Coach Vaught had 2 rules. 1, you cannot get married. 2, you cannot have a car on campus during football season.
And it was clear he was totally in charge. There was no ever a doubt about that.
But the Magnolia State was another southern land in turmoil then.
Fundamentally, this state has been one of the more polarizing, one of the more committed states as it relates to the history of racial discrimination, more so maybe than any other state in America.
I remember when we drove to California to visit some family in L.A. I remember the comment being made, my mom and dad, "We got to get up early because we got to be out of Mississippi before dark. You don't want to be in Mississippi when the sun goes down."
In the fall of 1962, Johnny Vaught would face his greatest challenge. Ole Miss was resisting integration as a man named James Meredith attempted to become the first African-American to enroll at the university.
Being on the Ole Miss campus is something like being in the eye of a hurricane. You know you're in the midst of trouble, but there's a quietness and serenity here that tries to mislead you.
If it came down to a question of either this man would attend school on campus or the school would have to be closed, what would be the general reaction of the student body?
I think they'd let it be closed before they let it be integrated.
I, Ross R. Barnett, do hereby, now, and finally deny you admission to the University of Mississippi.
The fire was only stoked further when the state governor, Ross Barnett, whipped a crowd into a frenzy at a Rebels game in Jackson.
I love Mississippi! I love her people! I love and I respect our heritage.
It all came to a head in a campus riot. Two people were left dead, hundreds injured, in what some would come to refer to as the last battle of the Civil War. 2 days after the campus riot, President Kennedy sent 40,000 troops in to restore the peace. A day later, James Meredith enrolled at Ole Miss.
And when James Meredith integrated Ole Miss, the headline says, Negro at Ole Miss, campus in chaos.
The 1962 Ole Miss team went undefeated for the only time in Rebel history.
Coaches talk all the time about overcoming distractions. Can you imagine the distractions that that team had? Coach Vaught wouldn't choose Archie or Jake Gibbs, who was his best player ever. He wouldn't choose the most monumental victory he ever won. But if you ask him who his favorite team was, it was definitely that 1962 team.
How Johnny Vaught kept that team together, I will never know.
There's only one civil rights period. There's only one civil war. There's only one American Revolution. I mean, that civil rights era is a piece of history that everybody wants to get on the bandwagon now. But they don't know what it was like.
I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
All the restaurants are segregated. The schools are segregated. The movie theaters are segregated.
The hospitals were segregated. If a white person was injured in Montgomery, Alabama, only a white ambulance could take them. I don't mean white in color. I mean, it was designated for white people. If a black person got injured or killed in the same street, they had to wait for the black ambulance.
How long, not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Dr. King's stance on nonviolence and the racist attitudes of the people in the state toward him for what he was trying to accomplish created a real sense of insecurity among people in the state about where you go, where you be at night, and so forth.
Out on the Mobile Highway coming into Montgomery, they actually had a sign out there saying, "Join Knights of the Ku Klux Klan," had a picture of a Klansman on a horse.
My grandmother lived by J.C. Fairground. They had Klan rallies right there across the street. We would sit there on the porch, and when those Klan rallies started, they would make us go inside.
Set up units.
They are a hooded bunch of killers and night riders and floggers that this nation and this state has no use for whatsoever.
We were always taught that we were not any better than anybody else. But nobody was better than us. And it was always the hope that one day we would have the same rights as everybody else. And you had to be prepared when that time came to compete and succeed and prove your worth.
In 1963, the state of Alabama was being ripped apart. Birmingham was in chaos. And 60 miles away, the State University in Tuscaloosa was also about to be at the forefront of the movement.
The University of Alabama campus at Tuscaloosa is under a tight security guard of state police. The federal officers are armed with a proclamation from President Kennedy urging the governor to end his efforts to prevent two Negro students from registering at the university.
I'm asking from you an unequivocal assurance that you will not bar entry to these students.
I was there. I was standing maybe 30 feet from Governor Wallace in the doorway of Foster Auditorium. I had a summer job there. I stayed in Tuscaloosa.
The illegal and unwarranted actions of the central government on this day, contrary to the laws, customs, and traditions of this state, is calculated to disturb the peace.
5 minutes after the governor leaves, James Hood is the first of his race to become a University of Alabama student. He is followed into the registrar's office by Vivian Malone.
A young lady that I was dating and Vivian were in the same dormitory on campus. And when I'd go over to visit my girlfriend, Vivian was in there in the lobby, whatever, we'd sit down and talk a little bit. She was humble, sweet, smart, you know, everything about her was cool.
A week before the 63 season began, another slice of horror struck down in Birmingham.
A man or men threw a bomb into a Negro church and killed 4 Negro girls who had been at Sunday school.
Alabama was engaged in a contentious struggle for the meaning of the word Alabama in the nation's consciousness.
You don't have to apologize for being a Mississippian or an Alabamian because...
Was it about bigotry, personified by George Wallace, Bull Connor, those 4 little girls? Or was it about excellence in football? Bryant's program was struggling to control that. There was all this negative attention, deservedly so, at the same time that Bryant has built the most dominant football team in the land.
With each incident, Coach Bryant kept us up to speed on what was happening and why and how to conduct ourselves properly with the respect that he was raised with.
To a lot of people in the country, it was easy to equate Bear Bryant and George Wallace. It was very easy to blur the lines, but it was a lot more complicated than that.
Bear Bryant, though very conservative politically, was appalled by Wallace's racism. He understood, partly because from Morrow Bottom, Arkansas, that people crossed over from one race to another race because you didn't live next door to just white people. That happens in cities. In the country, black people, white people were mixed and mingled in much more significant ways.
Bryant was paid to win football games. And the race issue was the third rail. It was the issue that you just did not want to touch.
Amid all the tumult, Bryant's team lost twice that year, with the second defeat coming in the Iron Bowl.
Quarterback Joe Namath runs for the 2-point conversion, but Auburn upsets Alabama 10-8, earning a trip to the Orange Bowl.
And in the wake of that loss came another disappointing revelation for the Tide.
I had broken a team rule. I did go to a party And Coach Bryant asked me a simple question after that, did you drink? And I did tell him, I broke his rule. And he put his hands up and fell back on the bed and started, no. I honest to God thought something happened to him. Scared me.
He was a guy who tried to treat all of his players fairly. Some were banished forever if they did something. Some were not.
With all those guys standing there and him looking at me, he said, if I let you come back and play, I'll retire after that because it's against my basic belief. And then we left the dorm. He wanted to walk with me. We crossed the street to the quadrangle. Went walking past Denny Chimes all across campus. And he said, you want to leave. I'll get you in somewhere else. I said, no, sir, I don't want to leave. He said, well, then this is what you got to do. And he told me what I had to do. I had to move out of the dorm, out of the athletic dorm. I had to make every class and walk a straight line until spring practice came. And then I would be able to come back out for the team if I didn't foul up. We had two games left against Miami, and then we had the Sugar Bowl. I wasn't going to be able to play that, and then I felt awful.
In the 1964 Sugar Bowl, Johnny Vaught and Bear Bryant brought their teams to a snowy Tulane stadium. Steve Sloan replaced Joe Namath and led the Crimson Tide to a 12-7 victory over the Rebels. Only 3 weeks later, Georgia Tech left the SEC. There were still hard feelings over the Darwin Holt hit, and Bobby Dodd thought the conference limit on football scholarships, 45, was too high, and that coaches would over-recruit and run players off.
I think in balance, most of us agree that it was not a good move. Many years later, exactly 10 years later, after I had played in the NFL for 10 years, Bart Starr hired me to be a scout. One of my campus stops was Tuscaloosa. Of course, Coach Bryant was up in his tower, and he had a bullhorn. Bill, why don't you come up here where you can see something? Oh my gosh. I didn't know what he was gonna say. You never knew what he was gonna say. And then he got quiet. He said, do you ever see Dodd? I said, yes, sir, I see Coach Dodd. He said, I'll never forget these words. Me and Dodd are too old to be feuding. I said, you're right, Coach. Because they were great friends up until that incident with the Darwin Holt thing. He said, I tell you what you do. You go home, you call Dodd, and you tell him I'll sponsor Georgia Tech back in the SEC. Well, I flew home, called Coach Dodd, and he was very pensive. He waited a long time before he answered, and he said, well, we're never going to get back in the SEC. But he said, I tell you what, we ought to resume the series, and Paul and I should not be fussing. We're old men now. So I'll call him.
When Joe Namath returned for his senior season in 1964, he looked better than ever, leading the team to three straight victories before going down with a knee injury. Even largely without him the rest of the way, the Tide would finish the regular season undefeated and be anointed national champions before taking on Texas in the Orange Bowl. 2 days before the game, it was reported that Namath was about to sign a contract with the AFL's New York Jets for $389,000, a record deal for a football player at the time.
the Texas Longhorns have possession. And here's a big one for the Longhorns. And number 23, their tremendous tailback, Ernie Coy, who goes on...
Down 14-0 to Texas. Bryant sent Namath, still injured, into the game.
Now, he came in all hobbling around on one knee and started throwing it around, yeah, and played pretty well.
Namath rallied the Tide to 1 yard shy of a comeback victory, falling 21-17. Up in the press box, Jets coach Weeb Eubank was said to shout, "I'm not paying this kid enough."
I'm a part of that Alabama history. I feel to this day blessed, lucky, fortunate, and thankful.
So Alabama is the national champion. Ha! National champion of what? The Confederacy? This team hasn't poked its head above the Mason-Dixon line since Appomattox. Jim Murray, Los Angeles Times.
This is an unlawful assembly. You are to disperse. You are ordered to disperse. Go home or go to your church.
When people talk about going to Birmingham and marching and defying the hoses, I wonder, why didn't I do that? I don't know. Why didn't I march across the bridge at Selma? I don't know.
Refuses to stand up for that which is right.
Yes.
A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice.
Yes.
We're going to stand up right here in Alabama.
I was oblivious. Most of us were. And I'm ashamed of that.
In 1964, a young, ambitious assistant coach at Auburn named Vince Dooley was hired by Georgia in an attempt to restore the pride of the Bulldogs.
Vince who? You know, when they said Vince, they thought it was going to be Vince Lombardi. Yeah, like, whatever.
31 years old, Auburn freshman coach. What is going on? The Georgia people were crestfallen.
Georgia's ship has gone through rough and battered seas, and we feel like that now among Georgia people that they are rallying to go forward with something progressive.
The timing was not ideal, with Dooley trying to carry his team up the SEC ladder just as Bear Bryant was beginning to assert his dominance. But in the opener of Dooley's second season, 1965, came a head-to-head test.
We were strictly a running team. As we got down to the question, what are we gonna do if we're behind and we need to catch up in a hurry? So I remember when I was a youngster playing football out in the street, we had this play where you would throw the ball high and then somebody would trail around and you would lateral it to him. It never worked in practice, as a matter of fact. But we were in that situation in the Alabama game. We had about 3 minutes left. We were behind. So we called the play. In fact, the quarterback kind of laughed. He said, you know, you serious?
Moore has Hodgson wide out to the left, dropped back, looking for Hodgson. Throws is complete. Hodgson levels the ball off to Taylor. Taylor's an opening to 50, 40, 35, to 30.
If we'd had instant replay, the play would have been called back because the guy was on his knee when he flipped the ball.
I don't know that his knees were ever on the ground, but it doesn't matter. it's just fun to debate it. After that, they call timeout.
And now a big decision by Georgia. They must decide to go for one and a tie or go for two and win.
The game was broadcast by NBC, the first time a network television game ever took place in Sanford Stadium. And the network had Bud Wilkinson in the fourth quarter with time running out. He left the booth and went down on the field to do interviews.
He was standing right next to me when we scored. I mean, he was jumping up and down.
He was so taken by this young staff and the audacity that it had. And Vince turns and says to him, says, "We're going for two." Bud says, "We got two."
Ball with a slot right, rolls out, looking, does throw. Georgia 18, Alabama 17.
For Alabama, it was a brutal loss, but the only one they'd sustain all season. And with Steve Sloan taking over full-time at quarterback, the Crimson Tide would be off to face an unbeaten and integrated Nebraska team in the Orange Bowl.
On the opening kickoff, there was a black player who fell at the feet of one of the Alabama players. And he said, "Don't kick me." Because to him, Alabama was Bull Connor and George Wallace.
Coach Bryant said, "What I want you to do, I want you to go out and I want you to knock them on their ass, and then I want you to extend your hand to pick them up."
The Tide offense exploded to a big lead and held on for a 39-28 victory, finishing off Bear Bryant's third national title in 5 years.
Growing up in the South, I would go up to these vending machines. They had bubble gum and little plastic gold footballs in them. I always wanted to get one of those gold balls that said Florida. It never happened. We got Yale, we got Harvard, we got Dartmouth, we got Penn State, we got Michigan, we got USC. Never Florida. We never saw our teams on TV. They were not on national television. Miami was the only other team in Florida that really was any good. FSU was really just sort of a figment of somebody's imagination. We got no respect from anybody.
He came from the Appalachian Mountains of eastern Tennessee, looking to throw the ball around a little. The University of Tennessee was out. They still ran the single wing. Alabama had Namath and Sloan behind him. But there was something about Gainesville, however moribund the program was, when Steve Spurrier showed up for a campus visit in the spring of 1962.
It was a beautiful sunny day, about 72 degrees. It was about 35 in Johnson City that weekend. And I said, "Man, I got a chance to come to Florida, play quarterback." Coach Graves said, "We're going to throw the ball." It seemed too good to be true.
The crowds would be sparse. The mascot may be a little too real. But the fit for the self-assured quarterback with fans starved for a star was perfect.
Well, they used to say he was cocky. He never liked that. He was very self-confident. Whatever he did in high school or anywhere, he was always good at it.
In 1966, his senior year, the Gators got off to a 6-0 start. And then, late in a tie game against Auburn, Spurrier looked to come through not with his arm, but his foot.
Steve always put a bag on the sidelines with a square-toed kicking shoe in it, just in case.
Well, I was sort of the long-distance field goal guy. Anything around 40 to 42, 3.
The clock was running out. A field goal would win it. So they called timeout. He came over the sidelines, put on his kicking shoe. At Auburn, Coach Jordan, Ralph Jordan, pronounced his name Superior. In his Selma, Alabama draw, he couldn't say Spurrier, so he called him Superior. And Hal Herring, the defensive coordinator, said, "Watch the fake, watch the fake." Coach Jordan turned around and just said, "You better hope it's a fake. If Superior kicks it, it's gonna go through."
Somehow or another, the ball went right through the middle. I had some help from above.
But the celebration was quickly followed by Spurrier's lowest moment as a Gator.
They had beaten Auburn on his famous 40-yard field goal the week before. Everybody full of themselves.
Went to Georgia, and they kicked our tails up and down the Gator Bowl that day. Knocked us out of the SEC championship.
And basically took away what he wanted to do the most, which was win the SEC.
Spurrier's 2,012 yards passing, 16 touchdowns, and one dramatic game-winning field goal nonetheless earned him the school's first Heisman, an achievement Gator fans would never forget.
And this is Coach Bryant being carried off the field by Joe Namath and myself after we beat Georgia Tech at Grant Field in Atlanta, and Joe came off the bench. He was hurt.
Most of Bear Bryant's players in the 1960s were poor farm boys, eager to please their coach.
Just old average old boys played above their head. That's what Coach Bryant could get you to do. He could get you to play better than you were. And you were going to be in so much better condition than the guy that you were playing against.
By 1966, over 8 years at Alabama, Bryant had built the SEC's unquestioned powerhouse. And the season began with a bid for the third straight national title. The team was small, averaging just 192 pounds a man, but loaded with talent, headlined by a new quarterback, Ken Stabler, starting despite Bryant's facetious insistence that he never trusted a left-handed crapshooter or a left-handed quarterback. Idle the first week of the 66 season, the Crimson Tide sat at number 3 in the rankings. But from there, won game after game after game. The lone close call coming on the third Saturday in October.
Coach Bryant hated Tennessee. He never beat Tennessee when he was at Kentucky. And that gnawed on him. We're behind 7-0 in the first 2 minutes of the game. We end up at the half, we're behind 10-0. Coach Bryant walks through the door and he's clapping his hands and he said, "We got them right where we want them."
I got to looking around and says, "He watching the same game we watching?"
He said, "They actually think they're going to win." He put a couple of plays up on the board. "And we're going to go out there and we're going to get after their ass."
Got real quiet. Coach Bryant started singing, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." And about that time, the referees knocked on the door and said, 10 minutes to kickoff.
The Crimson Tide charged back in the second half and took a 1-point lead. Tennessee missed the short field goal late, and the Tide held on for an 11-10 victory.
And we were undefeated. I mean, this is it. I mean, we're going for another national championship.
On November 19th, number 1 Notre Dame and number 2 Michigan State faced off and played to an infamous 10-10 tie, setting off a wave of criticism.
At the end, Notre Dame did not try to win the football game. And in fact, was trying just not to lose.
The Irish had the ball with less than a minute and a half remaining, but elected to run out the clock.
I believe it's the most cynical act in college football history. Eric Persegan understood that he could still win the national championship with a tie.
As Dan Jenkins of Sports Illustrated put it, no one really expected a verdict in that last desperate moment, but they wanted someone to try.
They were ranked 1-2 in the country. They played to a tie. Alabama should have gotten the top spot in the national polls, but they didn't.
Bryant didn't play for ties. He had some ties in his life, but he didn't play for ties. There was something fundamental about that.
Everything at Alabama is based on winning. I couldn't go for a tie late in the game. In our region, our football players have a far-reaching effect on young people. Some of them are going off to Vietnam every day, and I hope they aren't going over there for a tie. Paul Bear Bryant. Alabama would finish the 66 season unbeaten and untied at 11-0, punctuated by a thumping of Nebraska in the Sugar Bowl.
Keeps the ball, sweeps left and misses. 14 yards for the touchdown.
But the ending was bittersweet.
Stabler finally passes to Perkins.
With the Tide ranked third in the final poll.
And he's going all the way for a touchdown.
Even though ahead of them, Notre Dame and Michigan State had the tie on their records.
Yeah, 1966 team, this is Kenny Stabler, Wayne Cook, who caught the two-point conversion against Tennessee. That's old Jerry Duncan, and that's Bruce Stevens, who was the only sophomore that started on that team.
Sort of like there is now in college football, there was some Alabama fatigue, and Coach Bryant always felt that that team kind of got robbed.
This is the 1966 team that went undefeated, untied, and uncrowned.
This newly politicized generation of sports writers take it out on that all-white team. We're not going to give them the national title. They are so outraged. They were outraged at the brutality of the Selma March.
They're beating up people. They're turning dogs loose on people. They've got water hoses. I've had enough of Alabama.
No longer could Alabama, the football program, be separated from Alabama, the pariah on the national stage.
This is a 1965 national championship ring. This is the missing ring. This is the ring that was designed for us. It would have looked like this had we won the national championship.
And it's the only time in college football history, the only time, that a two-time defending national champion has gone undefeated that third year and been denied the national championship.
This is a missing ring.
And this one here is probably more important to me than anything. This one was given to me by Coach Bryant. And on the inside of it, it says, from Coach Paul Bryant to Jerry Duncan. And
nobody knew it at the time, but during that great 1966 season, there was a young freshman engineering student from Montgomery, just happened to be black, one of about 200 black faces on the campus in those days. He had been a football player in high school in Montgomery, turned down a chance to play at a historically black school to come to Alabama. That guy was Doc Rohn. He's a forgotten figure in the history of the Southeastern Conference. But he was a pioneer.
I knew it was going to be different. Being one among just a few blacks on campus, I knew that in many of my classes, I would be the only black in the class. So I felt a little different in that respect. There was so much history with Alabama. Alabama was in the news so much until I thought it would be a good place for me to go, plus pursue academic goals I wanted. I felt that I was there to compete with everybody else. It was in the fall of 66. I went to football games in Dennis Stadium, and I was blown away at how the fans were. I mean, it was something I had never seen before. The noise was just deafening. The whole time I'm watching these guys play, and I'm saying to myself, I can do that too.
So gathering his nerves, Doc Roan lined up a meeting with Coach Bryant.
He was sitting back behind his big desk in his chair. So you want to play football for Alabama? I said, yes, sir. It seemed like he just stopped him and was thinking. And he said, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do this. He said, if you come out for it, you'll be given a fair shot like everybody else. But as far as the black and white thing, he never mentioned that. His last words to me, he said, well, if you want to play football for me, you're going to have to cut that mustache off. If I told Joe Namath he got to cut his hair, you got to cut your mustache. I said, yes, sir. Later on that evening, my parents called. They said, do you know what we heard on TV today? We saw on TV. I said, what? You're going to be the first black football player at Alabama. They were all excited about it.
So the spring of 67, four of his African-American friends decided to walk on with him. Only two of the guys eventually stuck it out, okay? Purnell and Rome.
Spring practice for the Crimson Tide of Alabama. And everything seems to be just like any previous year, but it's not. Among the players, pass receiver Andrew Purnell. Big Doc Roan, the guard, likely to see first string action.
They were giving the defensive backs a drill when they would attack the ball carriers. And the guys were getting tired. And the coach said, well, I need some more running backs. And I said, well, I'll try it. As soon as he handed me the ball, and before I positioned myself to get ready, the defensive back hit me and knocked me square on my butt. And I just felt, when that happened, I felt like the eyes of the world were looking at me. And I felt so embarrassed. And he blew the whistle the next time. Defensive back came after me. Well, I tackled him just as well as he tackled me. But I just raised him up across the chest with my forearm and just knocked him out of the way. And I went around and got in line again. And the same thing happened. And the third time, the same thing happened. And the fourth time, the coach pulled me out. He said, you've gone through enough. Then all the butterflies and so forth went away. It was just football then. One day I was walking to practice, and this car pulled up next to me, and the windows rolled down, and I recognized him as being Coach Brown. He said, come on, get in. I said, wow. I got in, and we rode to practice, and we chatted on the way to practice, and he said, I like you. You got quickness. You're strong, and you keep it up. On Saturdays, we would ride to Dennis Stadium for our scrimmage, and I can remember thinking, I said, man, is this really happening to me? I used to get threats, you know, we don't want you playing Alabama, football at Alabama, go home, use the N-word, we don't want your kind at Alabama. But I never did receive any negative vibes from the football players.
Doc Roan appeared destined to be the first black player in the history of Alabama football until his uncle died that summer of 1967, and he dropped out of school to help his family make ends meet. None of the other African Americans who'd tried out stuck with the team either for a variety of personal reasons. Eventually, Roan re-enrolled and got his degree in 1974, but not without a measure of regret.
I think I should have gone back. I shouldn't have let things at home taken as much precedence as it did, because I think I could have been one of the starters on the team.
Meanwhile, the 1967 season would be a disappointment by Crimson Tide standards. 8 wins, 2 losses, and a tie. Though there was one play against one team that got etched into history. Ken Stabler running for the Iron Bowl's lone touchdown against Auburn. Then and forevermore, Stabler's run in the mud. Five years earlier, in 1962, a state senator named Richmond Flowers Sr. was elected the Attorney General of Alabama under Governor George Wallace. He moved his family to Montgomery for the job, and his son, Richmond Jr., enrolled at segregated Lanier High School.
When I first went up there, my name was Attorney General's boy. I was like, hey, I got a name, it's Richmond. And like any kid in high school, I was just struggling to be a part of it.
Richmond's father was a controversial figure. He'd originally won office on a segregationist platform, but then it had a change of heart.
My dad had taken the position that segregation was illegal and immoral, and that didn't go over very good with my friends.
When I first put out the call for law and order, a great many people said, why, he's committing political suicide. He's ahead of his time. All I say is, oh, how sweet it is to be ahead and not behind.
Somebody asked him, said, Mr. Flowers, are you a racist? And he said, yes, I was. It was society's first gift to me, but I have great hope for my children. My first year there, I had some struggles. I was ostracized a little bit, to say the least.
You feel that you are in personal danger in Lowndes County?
Yes, sir, I do. I do because of the threats that have been made to me by telephone.
We had hate calls. We had crosses burned in our yard. But it's amazing what being the fastest kid in the school and winning 5 events will do for your popularity.
As great a football player as Richmond was and even went on to play in the NFL, he was just an outstanding track star. I mean, he was so quick that when he hit the line, I mean, he was just gone.
Flowers was recruited by Bear Bryant in Alabama, but chose Tennessee, in part because of the Vols' strong track program, and also because of how he'd watched his father treated in their home state.
My daddy got beat up at one of my football games. Somebody just came up behind him, turned him, you know, said, tapped him on the shoulder, turned around, and they just clubbed him. I come from stock that doesn't quit. You just got to keep going. And no matter what happens to me, it can't be worse than what happened to him.
The lightning-fast Flowers excelled as a wingback and receiver in his sophomore and junior seasons, setting what was then a Tennessee record for career receptions.
From the colorful Smoky Mountain country of eastern Tennessee, we are ready to play football on a perfect autumn afternoon.
Then Flowers was moved to halfback as a senior, where his greatest highlight came against the team he'd spurned a few years earlier.
Richmond Flowers, he is down to the 2-yard line.
We kind of thought they'd kick a field goal or something. And next thing you know, the guy comes in and says, Coach Dickey said, call the same play again, but this time go over the top. I never practiced going over the top. I had no idea how you go over the top.
Pickens and Flowers set. It is Flowers! Touchdown! And our final score is Tennessee 10, Alabama 9.
I used to always get asked that question, why didn't you play for Bryant? Why didn't you play for Bryant? And one day I popped back, and I said, when they asked me that question, I said, well, I'd rather beat Bryant than play for him. That was not the right thing. I mean, I got murdered with hate mail and coming out of Alabama. In a way, it was true. That was what I was all about. I'd rather beat the best in the world than to be the sparring partner with the best in the world.
Thank you.
On Sunday mornings in Louisville, Kentucky, a pastor in his early 70s celebrates all the earth offers to revel in. But it's been a long journey to this point, often tough to make sense of and all too lonely. In 1965, Nate Northington was a star high school football player here in this city, a pivotal junction of the civil rights movement. The University of Kentucky had determined it was ready to be the first SEC school to integrate its athletic teams, and Governor Ned Breathitt was eager to assist any way he could.
When the governor, he asked me, well, when are you going to sign, you know, with us? All my friends would always ask me, say, you know, you're not really going to Kentucky, are you?
Northington was apprehensive about breaking the barrier, but he signed with the Wildcats after another African-American, Greg Page, committed as well.
I would have some help, you know, it wouldn't just be me by myself. I wouldn't be alone.
Greg Page was a charming, gregarious kid who quickly became close friends with Northington.
We were young. We didn't have any, you know, fear, I guess. We didn't know what fear was.
They played on the freshman team together in 1966. But then the following summer, tragedy struck. Page broke his neck in football practice and was paralyzed.
Greg actually requested that I come up to visit him just to see him in that condition. It was pretty devastating.
Page died 38 days after the injury and the day before the Wildcats' second game of the season.
None of us wanted to play, but Greg's parents felt that Greg would want us to go ahead.
So on September 30th, 1967, Nate Northington made history, becoming the first African-American athlete to play in the Southeastern Conference.
When I went out there, I knew that I was doing it not just for myself, but for Greg as well. I was playing safety that day. After about the third or fourth play, I went to make a tackle, stuck my arm out. This guy hit my arm and the shoulder just went out of place. You know, going to the locker room and having to go to the hospital. Integration was not really something that was on my mind. We had to go to the funeral that week, 100 and something miles from Lexington. We had to practice when we got back from the funeral.
Put on our pads and went out and practiced for 3 hours. After the funeral, it's brutal.
Overwhelmed by all that had transpired, Northington fell into a depression.
When Greg died, he really disappeared.
I had a difficult time, missed some classes. I didn't know what I was going through or what was happening with me.
Nowadays, when young men have traumatic experiences like that, they go through counseling.
Made up my mind to go talk to the other players and let them know what my intentions were.
He gathered us together, and as he told us, he said, I just can't take it anymore.
Northington left school, though he'd eventually finish his career at Western Kentucky. Meanwhile, Houston Hogg and Wilbur Hackett, who'd arrived a year after Northington and Page, soldiered on trying to finish what Page and Northington had started.
You talk about the South and how segregated it was. Well, we were the most hated people in that stadium. It looked like a Klan rally. You know, you heard the N-word. I sometimes felt like giving up and walking away. Because we were on a mission, we had to see the thing through, and we talked each other into sticking it out and toughening it out.
Hackett was from Louisville, but had always bled Kentucky blue.
I chose UK because my dad was a UK fan because of the people that he worked with. In 1950 and 51, when Bear Bryant was there, African Americans couldn't even go to the games. It wasn't allowed. It was segregated. Later on in my life, when I asked my parents, I said, how could you all cheer for UK back then when you couldn't even go to the games? It was segregated. And my mother said, son, we didn't see color. My dad loved UK, first of all. And then the fact that his son played football at UK, his chest was out here.
It would take years for the pioneers at UK to appreciate the accomplishment of their struggle, even if the stars who'd followed always knew the significance of the ones who'd come first.
I can't thank Nate enough for his courage. In 1975, it was tough, but I couldn't imagine what it was like in the 60s.
For many years, Nate ran away from that whole thing. 5 or 6 years ago, he began to embrace the fact that he was the first African American to play in the SEC.
Let's give God some praise, everybody. I know y'all looking at me and saying, he's too young to be able to play football 50 years ago. Is that what y'all thinking?
The struggles that you go through, makes you stronger.
Amen. There will be many that will make their claims of how worthy they are.
It never goes away. It's always with me. Because of Greg, number one, I promised myself that I would always let people know what he did. It wasn't a long period of time that I was there, of course. But once you make history, you make history.
Back in Tuscaloosa in 1970, Bear Bryant and John McKay scheduled the first ever regular season game between Alabama and USC. Two of the nation's most storied programs, separated by 2,000 miles and two very different cultures. The Tide, still an all-white team, were in a stretch of mediocrity. And USC ran all over Legion Field with their starting backfield of three African-American players. Most notably, Sam Cunningham and Alabama native Clarence Davis.
There's a saying that Sam Cunningham did more to desegregate Alabama in 2 hours than Martin Luther King did in 20 years. And yeah, it's a pithy little quote, but it is absolutely untrue.
But people like it. It sounds good to them. Sam Cunningham didn't start us recruiting black kids in Alabama.
The reality of that event is Bryant saw the new world coming, and there was no doubt in his mind where he was going to have to go.
Back more than a decade earlier at Kentucky, Bryant had tried to persuade the Kentucky administration to let him recruit African-American players, but was told it was too early. In the 1968 Gator Bowl, Alabama had been beaten soundly by an integrated Missouri team, after which St. Louis sports writer Bob Bragg listened as Bryant quizzed Missouri coach Dan Devine about recruiting black players, with Devine noting that he had less trouble coaching the blacks on his team than the whites. A year later in 1969, a recently integrated Tennessee team trounced Alabama at Legion Field.
I had signed Wilbur Jackson in 69. Now, I did have Alabama folks, and tell me, friends of mine, people that I knew well, said, you can't sign that. I said, what do you mean I can't? He said, I'm never coming to another game. I said, that's your choice. I said, but if Wilbur put his name on the line, I'm going to sign him.
So this is a tremendous, tremendous happening. And they couldn't have picked a better guy in the world to do it than Wilbur Jackson. And a guy who is, just mentally tough and a class individual.
He wasn't interested in becoming the Jackie Robinson of Alabama football. He just wanted to take the burden off his father. He wanted to be able to go to college on somebody else's nickel.
But this was before freshman eligibility. So while Jackson was out there practicing with the Alabama teams, he played a freshman football.
Which meant Jackson, Alabama's first African-American scholarship player, was watching from the stands when Sam Cunningham piled up 135 yards in the Trojans' rout of the Crimson Tide. So, whatever the historical significance of that performance was, there was no doubt it gave Bama fans a glimpse of the future.
It wasn't that Sam Cunningham changed Bryant's mind. It was that Sam Cunningham eroded the last bastion of resistance. I don't call them Subway alumni because there are no Subways in Alabama. I call them pickup truck alums, right in the heart of Klan country. These were the last resistors.
Alabama's last all-white team would finish the 1970 season 6-5-1. A year later, defensive lineman John Mitchell would actually become the first African-American to play for the Tide, though Jackson, the first to sign a scholarship with the team, would become a star in the Alabama backfield.
He was signed on December 13, 1969. You know, it's 14 years and 12 days after Rosa Parks. Just wanted to keep her seat on that bus in Montgomery. 14 years later, Wilbur Jackson is recruited by the white power structure in the state of Alabama to become the most exalted thing in the culture, and that's an Alabama football player. Rosa Parks and Wilbur Jackson are generational bookends as far as the civil rights movement are concerned in Alabama.
Across the SEC, what had begun in 1967 with Nate Northington at Kentucky continued through 1972 when all 10 of the conference's football teams were integrated.
You wish things could have happened sooner, but I'm sure, you know, Coach had a reason where, you know, the concern of thinking of when do you bring players into an environment to where they'll have a chance to succeed.
We can look back and say he missed an opportunity. But, he's paid to win football games. And he didn't want to push it too fast.
What if he had put one of his players out there where they are the subject of violence? The consequences could have been severe.
Is it fair to say he should have done it anyway for the sake of progress and culture and civil rights? Or if he believed in it, those in the sports world who have stood up at times like that are the ones that get remembered. He obviously is remembered for many things, but that may be one thing that we look back and say he had the power because of how much he was winning to take that stand, and he decided not to.
Nothing about that would have been easy, except this. Losing is hard down here. And to adhere to a doomed ideal and lose was unthinkable.
Bear Bryant would make other changes in the years ahead to prolong his team's dominance, all the while contending with young heroes at rival schools, capturing the imagination of millions as college football became more visible across the land through the ever-growing powerful medium of television.